From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Eric Westerveld. It's Here and Now. Well, it was Comey Week in America. James Comey, the FBI director who President Trump fired last year, did lots of media interviews this week about his new book, A Higher Loyalty. Did we really learn anything?
Last night, Comey's private memos about seven meetings he had with Donald Trump last year came out. Did they shed any light on the two men, their interactions, and the FBI's investigation into possible Trump campaign collusion with Russia? There was also other news, and let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable to talk about all of that. Jose Diaz-Balart is news anchor at Telemundo and NBC. Hello, Jose.
Hi, pleasure to be here.
And Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor for NPR. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
So Comey's memos have been described as an intimate look into the early months of the Trump presidency. Domenico, you first. Any new insights from the memos?
A lot more detail, obviously, that came out here, including President Trump's views of his former NSA director, his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, questioning his judgment and why Flynn, for example, did not return or tell the president about a phone call that he had with a foreign government and hadn't told the president until 6 days later. So there, even though President Trump was defending Flynn at the time and continues to defend Flynn now, possibly because of the fact that he really was the one who brought Flynn on board, there were questions that he had in private about this. Also, we learned again about how President Trump wanted to get that loyalty agreement from James Comey, and something made Comey uncomfortable.
I wonder if you can talk, Jose, about something else that we learned. The memos indicate that intelligence agencies had confirmed parts of the so-called Steele dossier, which, among other things, alleged a Trump meeting with prostitutes in Moscow. We learned that Donald Trump, according to Comey's memo anyway, claimed that he spoke with Vladimir Putin of Russia at some point, and supposedly that Putin bragged that Russia had, quote, some of the most beautiful hookers in the world. Such an unusual conversation, for one thing, for a president to be having with the FBI director, or for Putin to be having with Trump, if indeed it did happen. How are you reading that?
You know, it's fascinating because I don't recall in recent history this kind of detail ever being in the public sphere. Detail of a president's conversation with the acting FBI director. Details of you know, what the president thought of world leaders, including Egypt's leader at the time, how, you know, he was upset and obviously naturally and logically upset over a report saying that he had been with prostitutes in Russia and that there was some other things going on there with them. But just the detail of private conversations between the president of the United States of America and the leader of the FBI, and then the phone calls that they're also in these memos, the initial phone calls that President Trump had with the leader of Australia and with Mexico that were leaked. It really does seem extraordinary. We're living in extraordinary times, and we're getting really to peel back at least one person's recollection of private conversations he had with the president of the United States of America, and they aren't pretty.
We also learned that Trump mused about jailing journalists who leaked to get them to cough up their sources. In an interview with Comey, CNN host Jake Tapper pressed Comey on his motivations for revealing sensitive information now and his thoughts on Trump tweeting that he should be jailed for leaking. Let's take a listen.
When he calls for the jailing of private citizens in his tweets, don't shrug, but realize that's not okay. That's not normal.
It's interesting that you won't go as far to say as that Hillary Clinton would be, the nation would be better off if Hillary were president, because you have called for the nation to respond to the challenge of Trump, in your view, by voting, presumably by voting against what he represents. Is that not a fair interpretation?
I actually think of it, maybe it's the same thing, but I think of it in terms of voting for something else, which is the core values of this country, which are more important.
Domenico, as we wrap up Comey Week, your thoughts on that and the week?
Well, I mean, you know, James Comey was certainly the biggest winner this week was his publisher, because right. he was right. able to get a lot of, you know, attention for this everywhere you turned, starting last Friday. So we're a week in to Comey mania, and you get more of it. You know, I don't know what it did to move the needle on any of Trump's supporters. I don't know that anything really could, but I think that he certainly was able to sort of he may have undermined his own credibility when it comes to trying to win more people over. But I think in 10, 15 years from now, we'll be looking back on the top line thing to say, wow, what an extraordinary moment. A Republican former FBI director came out and said the president of the United States, who is currently serving as president, was unfit to be in office.
Jose, yeah, and I was fascinated by his comment of when the president calls for jailing of people, don't shrug. Don't make it normal. And then reading his memo, he said that when the president, as Comey was walking out of the Oval Office, said to him about putting reporters in jail, they spend a couple of days in jail, make a new friend, and then they're ready to talk, said the president. And Comey's answer was, I laughed as I walked to the door.
Here's what Trump said about James Comey when he was asked about him at a news conference with the Japanese prime minister this week.
There was no collusion. And that's been so found, as you know, by the House Intelligence Committee. There's no collusion. There was no collusion with Russia other than by the Democrats, or as I call them, the obstructionists, because they truly are obstructionists.
Domenico, we've heard that before. What do you make of it, though?
Well, you know, I mean, President Trump wants to have as much as he can get done almost unilaterally. And I think that the system of checks and balances has frustrated this president like it frustrates a lot of presidents. And he's particularly mm-hmm. new to the system. He didn't even run a publicly held company. He ran a privately held company. So he was able to do whatever he wanted, however he wanted. And so I think that the strictures and the restrictions that government put in place, he doesn't like them. And he wishes that things could run more smoothly. And that's just not how it works.
Couldn't agree with you more, Domenico. And then add to that that here is a neophyte in politics. A neophyte, you know, has no concept of what it is to run a federal bureaucracy. And then add to that when he's having conversations with foreign leaders, they're leaked. I mean, it's really as I say, I mean, this is really an unusual time.
Moving on to other topics, Domenico, I'm curious. I mean, do you think CIA Director Mike Pompeo has enough votes to become Secretary of State?
Well, it's going to be close. Pompeo certainly may have gotten a little bit of a boost, actually. I think conservatives are hoping with his trip to North Korea that was unveiled this week, because some of the criticism about Pompeo has been that he is not somebody who's very diplomatic. And here he is leading, apparently, or as the point man on North Korea, having met with Kim Jong-un now. The question I think we all have to have it substantively is talks are never a bad thing. It's what do you get in return for those talks? And the president sort of alluded to the idea that if the U.S. isn't getting anything in return, then he would walk away from it. But the U.S. has already promised very high-level talks. They already delivered a very high-level person. They didn't get people who are jailed in North Korea out of there. And we don't know that really Kim Jong-un is looking to denuclearize. So what does the United States get out of this?
And Jose, your thoughts on that secret diplomacy by spy masters?
I was just blown away by the fact that the acting director of the CIA actually went and met with Kim Jong-un. I mean, just think about that for a moment. The head of the CIA meeting with Kim Jong-un, who may be the next Secretary of State. Look, these are so preliminary. These are so secret. These are so there hasn't been a lot of leaks about that coming out. But any time that you have a meeting with a dictatorship that is at war, essentially, with, its neighbor and needs Americans there on the front lines to protect war from coming out and being a hot war. These are very delicate conversations. I think that, Domenico, I agree with you that his going over to North Korea probably will help him in the confirmation process.
There is also, of course, this week, talk about Syria. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham is one of Trump's sharpest critics on Syria strategy. He said that he's more worried than ever. This was after a briefing with U.S. military officials. I want to ask you, Jose, though, about Cuba. There was very little reaction from the Trump administration on news out of Cuba this week that the president, Raul Castro, is stepping down, the end of his tenure, and a new president has come in. Is this a new chapter, do you think, for the U.S. and for Cuba?
That's a great question. Look, I think of this new quote-unquote president, Díaz-Canel, as of kind of Kim Jong-nam with a guayabera. Kim Jong-nam is the chairman of the presidium of the Supreme People's Assembly in North Korea. He's the guy that accompanied the sister of Kim Jong-un to the Olympics. Remember that?
Yeah.
And there's and he's the president. And I don't think there's any doubt that that president, Kim Jong-nam, really doesn't have a lot to do in that dictatorship other than accompany the sister in meetings. Well, that's Díaz-Canel. I mean, it's a joke to think that a dictatorship that has been in power for 60 years, two brothers have had it. They name presidents. Remember that Fidel Castro named presidents as early as January of 1959 when he took power. He put a guy in for one day, didn't like him, put another guy in that lasted another day, put another guy in that lasted a couple of months, and then put another guy in that lasted 17 years until Fidel Castro said, you know what, my turn to be president. That's what's going on.
We got to leave it there. Jose Diaz-Balart is a news anchor at Telemundo and NBC, and Domenico Montanaro is lead politics editor at NPR News. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
The winners of the George Foster Peabody Awards have been announced in the entertainment and children and youth categories. They include Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale and Amazon's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. The Peabodys have a long history. They were established in 1941 to award excellence in radio broadcasting, and now they honor many kinds of broadcast media. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to talk about them. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So you're on the current board of jurors. Next year, you're going to be the board's chair. How do you determine the finalists and the winners? What are the qualities you look for?
Well, it's a really interesting process. This year, we had 16 different judges from all different areas of scholarship and media and business. We had people like Marcy Carsey, who heads the company that created The Cosby Show and Roseanne and Grace Under Fire and A Different World, all these great sitcoms. We also had John Huey, who is former editor-in-chief of Time, Inc., and Mark McKinnon, a well-known political strategist. So we had a nice cross-section of people. We all get together, and we try to decide the best things that have appeared in broadcast, streaming, online, radio in the past year, and we all have to agree, which means we all have to pretty much have seen it. So it's quite a challenge.
That's pretty amazing that it has to be unanimous. So when you get to something like the entertainment category, I would think it would be really difficult and arduous because entertainment is so broad and there are so many different opinions. Let's talk about the winners who were just announced yesterday, in fact. Who are they?
Yeah. In fact, scripted entertainment tends to be the most subjective. So trying to judge the quality of a comedy like The Good Place on NBC, for example, versus a winner like The Handmaid's Tale, which was announced, we're looking at the impact of the show. We're looking at the quality of the show and also how it connects to important issues in society. So The Handmaid's Tale stood out because this was a story about women being oppressed in a theocracy, in a sort of alternate future. And it gave us a new way of looking at issues of toxic masculinity and how women are held back in society and even slavery, because these women are treated like slaves and forced to serve as breeders for the men who run the society. And we even have a clip from this show. So let's check a little bit of it out.
A chair, a table, a lamp. There's a window with white curtains. And the glass is shatterproof, but it isn't running away, they're afraid of. A handmaid wouldn't get far. It's those other escapes. The ones you can open in yourself, given a cutting edge.
So that's Elizabeth Moss, who plays Offred, a character known as a handmaid. You know, she does an amazing job, you know, playing this character, and the series itself does a great job. Another one that we'll be awarding is Hasan Minhaj's Homecoming King, which is this one-man show that he brought to Netflix that talked a lot about his immigrant experience and also talked about how he felt like he was treated and how he's tried to create his own American experience in the wake of all these things. And given the way we've been talking about immigration and talking about immigrants in this country, it's a wonderful way of exploring these issues through the guise of a comic who's really funny. And Hassan is going to be hosting the Peabody Awards when we actually hand them to people on May 19th. And we've got a clip from that one, too. So let's check it out.
When it came time for me to get married, I got married to a girl from a Hindu family. Oh, I heard an audible, oh. I heard you go like, ugh, I didn't punch you. Like, all right, so some of you guys don't know. So Hindus and Muslims are like the Montagues and Capulets of India. And we've been warring for centuries. And I know some of you guys are like, what's the difference? I take yoga, you guys all look the same. So how would I,
I think I want to see that, or if not that, then watch the show. It should be a very interesting award ceremony.
Exactly, and that's one of the things, that's the great things about the Peabody's, is that you can look down our list of winners, and it's basically a viewership guide. Particularly, you know, people may not check out that many documentaries. We got hundreds of documentaries this year, so the ones that we have on our list are pretty amazing. I mean, Last Men in Aleppo, about the White Helmets who you know, they run to help people when bombs may devastate a city in Syria. And then we also awarded one called Time, the Khalif Browder story. And it's this affecting story. It was executive produced by Jay-Z about this young African-American boy who was arrested at age 16. He was accused of stealing a backpack, but they never proved it. But because he wasn't allowed to make bail, he had to sit in Rikers Island, this notorious prison in New York, for 3 years. It was so traumatic for him that even after he was released, he wound up taking his own life a few years ago. And I think we have a clip. Let's check it out.
If I just say that I did it, nothing's going to be done about it. I didn't do it. No justice is served. Nobody hears nothing at all. I had to fight. You want me to walk away like it's okay? It's not okay.
So this film sort of brings together all the things that we know are terrible about a criminal justice system. People being unjustly accused, people having to sit in jail because they can't make bail, people who are stuck in inhumane jailing conditions. And then what happens when you're released and your life has been completely upended and you have to try to make your way after going through this horrible trauma. So that's one reason why we picked that film.
Eric, you and the other jurors also honored Carol Burnett with the first ever Career Achievement Award for the Peabody's. There are many notable broadcasters and entertainers to choose from, so why Carol Burnett in particular?
Well, this is always an interesting award because we want to pick people who have a long history of excellence in broadcasting, and then we also want to look for times when it's particularly significant. So Carol Burnett, you know, just celebrated the 50th anniversary of her landmark TV show on CBS, and she even has a new series coming out on Netflix on May 4th. And so it seemed like a really opportune time to tip the hat to her and really recognize her as a pioneer in comedy in ways that maybe people haven't considered for a while.
And there are still awards to be given by the Peabody's in news, public service, and radio podcast categories. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, a juror this year in the Peabody Awards, will be chair next year. Nice to speak with you, Eric. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Now, from television to live theater performance. Every year, American Theater Magazine compiles a list of the most produced playwrights in regional theaters across America. And for the past 2 years, after William Shakespeare, that playwright has been Lauren Gunderson. Never heard of her? Chances are there's a theater near you that's performing a play by this 36-year-old San Francisco-based writer. Jeff London has this profile of Lauren Gunderson.
Playwright Robert Anderson famously remarked, "You can make a killing in the theater, but not a living." But Lauren Gunderson does make a living. A good living.
You don't get tenure as a playwright. But yeah, with the right amount of plays and the kind of consistent and creative collaborative partners in theaters all over the country, then yeah, there's a way to do it, which is shocking even to me.
Well, I think she's a great playwright.
Davis McCallum is artistic director of the Hudson Valley Shakespeare Festival in Garrison, New York, which did one of Gunderson's plays last summer.
Even more remarkable is that she's become America's most produced living playwright without having had a major New York City production. And I think that's because she's writing really good plays that speak to people where they are and that expand our idea of what's possible in the theater.
Yeah, here we stand in my room. Why?
We have that project we're supposed to do.
That's from a production of I and You at the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble in Pennsylvania last January. It's Lauren Gunderson's most produced play out of a catalog of 20. And even though it only has two teenage characters, it deals with big issues. The girl, Caroline, has been gravely ill waiting for a liver transplant. And over the course of 90 minutes, she and a classmate talk about typical teenage things and poetry and death.
Okay. Rules number 1 through 400, don't be nice to me.
What?
Because when everyone is so nice, nice is fake. Everybody tries to make things upbeat and positive, and it's like, I'm not an idiot. I get what you're doing, and you're making it worse.
It was very important to me to explore a female protagonist who is very complex and isn't that very tedious word, quote, likable. And I always like to say, well, Hamlet isn't very likable when we meet him either, but but he's pretty iconic.
The play received its world premiere at the Marin Theater Company outside of San Francisco, where Gunderson's the resident playwright. Artistic director Jason Minidakis says part of the reason her plays are so popular is their intellectual bent. They often tackle historical, scientific, or literary subjects, usually with small casts, which makes them affordable. But he thinks the most important reason may be Gunderson's upbeat point of view.
It's a very optimistic perspective, and I think that's something that producers are looking to put in front of their audiences right now. There's a strong humanist streak in her, and there's not a lot of sarcasm or cynicism in her work. So for people who are looking for a counterpoint to a lot of what's done in the American theater, I think that's what she brings.
Lauren Gunderson, who grew up in Georgia, says theater is her church and storytelling her mission.
I specifically want to write plays that give a certain feeling at the end of them. The best I can describe it is something like hard hope. It's not easy. It's not all wrapped up. Everything's not glittery with free cupcakes for everyone. But you feel like it's worth going on, like you've learned something that makes you better. You've been through a hell of a lot to learn that thing, but you're better for it.
And the prolific playwright already has 5 new works in the pipeline. Next up is Natural Shocks, a one-woman play about gun violence in America. 60 theaters across the country will be presenting it this evening. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff London.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Students in about 2,000 schools across the country have walked out of class today to demonstrate against gun violence. Connecticut high school pupil Lane Murdoch set up the event after the Parkland school shooting in Florida. Today's event marks the 19th anniversary of the Columbine High School massacre in Colorado. After that attack, the state of Colorado set up a hotline to let students share their safety concerns anonymously. It's called Safe to Tell. In the years since, the program has become a model for other states. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Sackis reports.
At Lakewood High School, parents, teachers, and staff find seats in the auditorium's bleachers. They're here to talk about school safety.
These are kids in crisis calling out for our help.
That's John McDonald, Executive Director of Security for Jefferson County Schools. He tells the crowd the district has received more than 1,300 anonymous reports this school year through the Safe to Tell tip line. Kids can use the mobile app, the phone number, or the website to report their concerns. And tips are answered 24/7 by state police.
If it's important enough for them to call, it's important enough for us to respond.
Schools get each report and work with law enforcement on how to follow up. When a student is in danger, McDonald says they act fast.
We had a report that a student was in the process of completing suicide. When law enforcement got there and kicked the door in, they were able to rescue her.
Most of the student tips in Jefferson County last school year involved threats of suicide. Plans for school attacks were number 7 on the list. McDonald says through tips, they've discovered hit lists created by students, explosive devices, and weapons. Since the Parkland shooting, at least 2 of the calls to the tip line have resulted in arrests.
The ghost of Columbine is with us today. It's never far from our mind, but on a tragedy is born a program that is saving kids' lives.
Utah and Nevada now have similar programs, and after the shooting in Parkland, Florida secured state funding to develop their own hotline, which they hope to have up and running by the end of the year. Susan Payne is the director and founder of Colorado's Safe to Tell. In the 90s, she started working as a school resource officer.
And when I was in that school, what you really learned is that young people knew information that we needed as adults to intervene. And yet there was a code of silence.
The hotline isn't enough, however. Payne and others argue schools need more money and more counselors to respond to mental health and violence issues. 14-year-old Harris Galvin would agree. At the March for Our Lives rally in Denver, she says she tried using the hotline for a friend who said he was going to kill himself.
Because he left a note on his Snapchat story, and I called in to see if they could do anything about it, and they informed me that there were police already responding on the scene.
Galvin says help didn't get there in time. Police confirmed that her friend, a middle school student, killed himself in August of 2017. The Columbine shooting also prompted researchers at CU Boulder to create a Center for the Study of Violence Prevention. Bill Woodward directs the center's training programs.
95% of violence does start in this age group going to school, so we've got to get to them now.
He says violence prevention in schools can have a lasting impact. For NPR News, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sakis in Denver.
Hans Asperger was a pediatrician who pioneered research of autism spectrum disorder. One type of autism now bears his name, Asperger's syndrome. Dr. Asperger worked in Vienna during the 1930s and 40s when the Austrian capital was under Nazi rule. He always maintained that he protected his child patients from the Nazis. But newly uncovered documents reveal Asperger may have collaborated with the Nazi regime. The evidence suggests Asperger even referred children to a notorious Nazi clinic where they were killed. Medical historian Hervig Cech made the discovery, and he's in Vienna. Mr. Cech, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your research prompted an editorial in the journal Molecular Autism, which said that Asperger, quote, willingly became a cog in the Nazi killing machine. What exactly did you uncover about Asperger?
Well, I think the most important discovery, as I see it, is the fact that there were two little girls, actually, that he referred directly to a clinic in Vienna that was known, at least among insiders such as himself, as a euthanasia clinic. It was an institution that served as a killing center in the context of the so-called child euthanasia program.
And this was a notorious clinic in Vienna where hundreds of children are said to have been killed, correct?
Yes, it was a so-called Spiegelgrund clinic or institution, and it was part of a secret network of such killing institutions that were spread all over Nazi Germany. In Vienna alone, over 700 children died in this institution, many of them poisoned by bitterates until they would die mostly of pneumonia.
Remind us again why the Nazis wanted to kill these children.
The child euthanasia program was part of a larger effort to purge the German body politic from people that were considered unworthy to live, that were considered hopeless cases, that who could not be expected to contribute to the war effort, to the economy, to the society at large.
Dr. Asperger was not a member of the Nazi Party, and he long claimed to have protected his patients from the Nazis. Do we know if Asperger knew what would happen to these children?
Well, officially, the child euthanasia program was, of course, a state secret. It was a closely guarded secret. But at the same time, word spread. We do know that many people who were family members, for example, relatives, but also the wider public found out what happened there. There were even public demonstrations at one point in Vienna. So it was very much an open secret.
So in your view, he clearly knew what he was doing?
I think he must have known. It's very hard to imagine that he could have no idea what he was doing. And additionally, we have to take into account that in these specific cases, there's evidence that especially in one of them, that the mother more or less expected the child to die, that she was that she agreed with this, that this was some kind of solution of a last resort. And so this is a very strong hint or evidence that Asperger somehow consented to this.
Dr. Asperger died in 1980. Why did it take until now to learn about his Nazi connections?
Well, first of all, for a long time, documents were not easily accessible or not accessible at all. The files of the Spiegelgrund victims, for example, they remained in the care of the psychiatric hospital where all this happened for a very long time before they were transferred to an archive where proper access for researchers was possible. But we also have to emphasize that Asperger, from the standpoint of the child euthanasia program, of the other extermination programs against psychiatric patients, he was not the central figure. He was a marginal figure. He contributed, he made a little contribution, which is, of course, shocking also in the light of his reputation, in the light of his own standards, I would say. But he was not the central player, and that's why his role was overlooked for so long.
Mr. Check, until now, Dr. Asperger has been revered as a pioneer in the field of child psychiatry. Back up a little bit. Remind us what his contributions were.
Well, he was the first to designate a group of children with distinct symptoms as autistic psychopaths, and therefore lay the groundwork for the concept of autism in the medical field. Although we have to say that it's still controversial if his symptom is really an independent clinical entity or if it should be treated as such. Leo Kenner in Baltimore around the same time described a much more severe form of autism. There are experts today who claim that this should be kept totally separate as concepts. But clearly he was one of the first, if not the first, to draw attention to autism in the broad historical sense.
For people with Asperger's, could there be an added stigma now that their condition is linked to a Nazi collaborator? I mean, should we be talking about changing the name of the syndrome?
Well, as for an additional, a taint linked to this, I certainly would hope not. I'm sure that for many people, this raises very serious questions about this link, about these associations. But in no way, I think people diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome should be affected by this directly or in the view of society. As for the eponym, as I mentioned before, the question of its clinical usefulness of the concept is in dispute, and as a historian, I cannot really speak to that. But from a historical standpoint, I do not think that the eponym Asperger's syndrome should be purged from history because of these connections to National Socialism. There are other eponyms with similarly troubling origins in Nazi Germany, and I think these should be used with caution. They should be used as an opportunity to learn about history, to reflect on history, but not to be, not to erase them from history simply.
That's Hervig Cech, a historian at Vienna Medical University who uncovered Dr. Asperger's dark past. Hervig, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, is this mic on? Kidding. Today's April 20th, 420, an unofficial holiday for weed aficionados. It's the biggest sales day of the year for cannabis products. And AAA, ride-hailing companies and police departments around the country want to remind people not to smoke and drive today or on any other day. Lyft teamed up with Super Troopers. The movie Super Troopers 2 opens today to create this, which is part ad, part public service announcement.
We are on a mission to protect and serve the citizens of America against those who would attempt to disrupt the order of our highways.
Boring.
And meow that we've heard that potheads are entitled to smoke freely. We take our job more seriously than ever. So this 420, if you're trying to get higher than a fruit bat, don't drive. Call a Lyft ride instead.
Today in Colorado, where weed is legal, the Mile High 420 Festival is expected to attract tens of thousands of people lighting up. Here's Sonny Jackson, the Director of Communications for the Denver Police Department.
We do enforce the law like any other day. It is not a pass to just smoke marijuana. And then we also do caution. We put out messaging every year that driving impaired is extremely dangerous, and we take it very seriously. Right now we have something on social media talking about you can pick your ride, whether it be a cab or a police car. You don't want to drive impaired.
A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine in February showed that the risk of fatal car crashes is 12% higher on April 20th, and for drivers under 21, the risk is 38% higher. Since Colorado legalized recreational marijuana in 2014, Jackson says the Denver Police Department has added more drug recognition officers.
We hired more of those to be on the street to recognize and look for individuals who are driving impaired. By virtue of the fact that now you have more people probably that are indulging, I'm sure we're seeing more numbers like that. But generally, we'll test for alcohol first and marijuana as a secondary test.
Adult recreational use is now legal in 9 states: Alaska, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and in the District of Columbia. And these state marijuana laws clash with federal law, which says pot is illegal. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer plans to introduce legislation today to decriminalize marijuana at the federal level. Speaking on Vice News last night, Schumer says he wants the drug to be removed from the list of Schedule I drugs and to set up funding for women and minority-owned marijuana businesses.
I've seen too many people's lives ruined because they had small amounts of marijuana and served time in jail much too long. It affects communities of color disproportionately and unfairly. And ultimately, it's the right thing to do. Freedom.
Even former House Speaker Republican John Boehner is joining the party. He announced recently he's joining the board of a marijuana company and that he will advocate for legalization. More lawmakers are pushing to change that federal law, which is giving weed advocates something new to celebrate this year.
This week, 100 top U.S. universities are committing to correcting a problem. It's rare for low-income students to be enrolled in America's most selective schools, as NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
How rare? High-achieving, low-income students make up just 3% of enrollment on elite colleges. And that frustrates Mark Slissel, the president of the University of Michigan.
There's no data to suggest that if you happen to be born into a less well-to-do family, you're somehow less intelligent or less educable. There's no data that says that.
And yet, a vast number of these students are not even applying to top colleges.
To be honest, we've done a poor job identifying and recruiting students from the lower half of the income spectrum in my home state of Michigan.
And that's one of the reasons the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor has signed on to the American Talent Initiative, a network of schools backed by Bloomberg Philanthropies, the Aspen Institute, and the research firm Ithaca SNR. Some of the best and largest schools in the country are involved: Yale, Johns Hopkins, and many of the University of California campuses. Their goal? Enroll 50,000 more of these students by 2025.
Often if you're a first-generation family, no one's gone to college, you're thinking that it's just not for you.
That's Rebecca Blank, the chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. In February, the school started offering free tuition for in-state students with family incomes below $56,000.
It's partly money, but it's partly also just really making it clear that we are affordable to low-income and moderate-income families.
Slissel says Michigan is doing it too. Free tuition if your family makes less than $65,000.
Half the families in my state are below that level. And to me, attracting students from that part of the socioeconomic spectrum is part of diversity on campus.
Doing this in partnership with other schools gets them talking, sharing information, what works and what's backfired.
We'll learn the most effective things and the most impactful things on an ongoing basis from each other.
That's Michael Drake, the president of The Ohio State University. He got a great idea from Michigan to follow up on recruitment letters and emails with phone calls and invitations to visit campus.
That seemed to be very effective and more effective than just sending a letter.
So OSU is trying it out.
We hope to help by sharing information and success stories as well as failures.
That's Biddy Martin, the president of Amherst College, a liberal arts school in Massachusetts. Because of their small size and large endowment, they've been able to lead the way in serving low-income students.
Maybe the most important thing we're doing is trying to identify what I call opportunity gaps.
So it's not just paying for tuition. It's funding unpaid internships or travel with professors. She says Amherst and all these other schools, they have a lot of rethinking to do.
I think the institutions have to let themselves be changed by the student bodies we have.
Or the kind of students they hope to have. For Here and Now, I'm Alyssa Nadworny.
Great Britain is sizzling under unusually warm spring weather, and that could affect the 40,000 runners in Sunday's London Marathon. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock is our marathon man. He covered the drenching wet and way too cold Boston Marathon this past Monday. He's now dried off. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Lisa.
So one extreme here, another one over there. What's the forecast for London on Sunday?
It's going to be hot like it's been all week in the city of London. Yesterday, Lisa, in fact, it was the hottest April day in London in 69 years. It got up to 84 degrees on Thursday, and it's almost as hot again there today. I talked to Darren Bett. He does the weather on BBC television, and here's what he said about the marathon forecast on Sunday.
So we're looking at Sunday's temperatures to be around 21, 70 Fahrenheit. There is actually a cold front, a weather front moving in from the west during the day. And now it looks as though it's quickened up a little bit, which is why we're only going for 70 rather than anything even higher than that. You know, when you're setting off in the morning and people often have a long wait before they actually start the marathon, the last few years it's been cold and in some cases it's actually been frosty. It's not going to be like that at all. We're looking at temperatures around about 60 Fahrenheit for 8 o'clock in the morning, and obviously rising to 70 by the afternoon. It probably won't be quite as warm as that for the faster finishers, but for most people, like if I was doing it, it'll still be 70, let's put it that way.
The hottest London marathons were in 1996 and 2007. It got up to 72 degrees for those races.
Wow, and that can be pretty dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be dangerous. Running in the heat, very dangerous. A runner actually died at the Chicago Marathon back in 2007. It got up to almost 90 degrees that day. They actually had to stop the race because it was so hot. The main advice for London runners, though, is to adjust their expectations. You're just not going to be able to run as fast as you could if the weather was cooler. Here's more from the BBC's Darren Bett.
They've actually put some showers up around the course. I believe there's 6 showers that you can run through on the 26 point whatever it is route around London to cool yourselves off. And that's what people are going to have to do, keep themselves cool. There'll be more water available for people to use around the course, not just to drink, to tip it over them to cool off as well. Because if it's warm with those sort of temperatures and the sun is out, it's going to be very, very difficult.
You know, there are actually people in London who participated in the Boston Marathon on Monday. I'm thinking of the wheelchair racers Marcel Hoog and Tatiana McFadden. They won in Boston. They're going to be trying to win another marathon in the same week under completely different weather conditions.
Okay, one extreme to the other. Yep. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.